Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The District Court erred when it granted summary judgment in favor of Officer Anderson. This case was about Officer Anderson's subjective knowledge of a substantial risk. Farmer v. Brennan requires only that the defendant be aware of facts from which an inference can be drawn that a substantial risk exists, and the defendant must draw the inference. Here, Officer Anderson herself, in her written log 4 hours before the attack, tells us that she knew the facts. Cells 6 and 19 were not secure, and she draws the inference. She wrote security risk in two different places. Under Farmer, this is enough to establish her subjective knowledge, certainly at summary judgment. For the district court to ignore her security risk warnings at summary judgment when it's required to construe all facts and draw all inferences in favor of Mr. Jr. was error.
Now, I gather that only one of the prisoners in the unsecured cells participated in the attack on Mr. Jr. Do we know anything about the role he played in the attack, or just is all we know that he participated in some way?
We know that Antoine Murray from the lockdown cell was one of the attackers. We don't know how many attackers there were. We know there were more than one. There were multiple attackers. There are three incident reports in the record, and in the appellate record, but not before the district court, are many more, about 14 or 15 more incident reports of attackers, including one from Raymond Anderson from another lockdown cell.
And a cell, as I recall, with Raymond Anderson, not to be confused with officer, that was not identified as an unsecure cell. He was in cell 2.
Right. There was no indication. Officer Anderson was not aware of that cell being not secure.
Well, is that just a mistake about Raymond Anderson, or did he actually come out of his cell?
Well, Your Honor, I would think it would be a strong inference that he came out of his cell, and that goes to Officer Anderson's reckless acts. In light of her knowledge
there was just the one cell that was unlocked on the top tier.
She identified one on the lower tier and one on the top tier at the beginning of her shift at 3:01. And then the attack occurred. Antoine Murray was one of the attackers.
Was Raymond Anderson in a cell that was unlocked? Or is his name in there by some mistake?
He was identified in subsequent interviews as one of the attackers. He was in one of the cells that was required to be locked under the lockdown policy. There's no evidence.
He was in the cell that we know was unlocked.
No, but
so
for him to have.
That there's another cell that was unlocked?
I'm sorry, say that again.
Is the idea that there was another cell that was unlocked that Summer Anderson didn't notice?
Yes. Well, Your Honor,
one of Mr. Jr.'s theories all along has been that Officer Anderson actually let some low side people out of their cells. That
yes.
He heard kind of clicking sounds, and then we have these later reports of the incident that would tend to corroborate that.
Yes, there's also
properly here.
There's also a declaration. There's three declarations from other detainees that say Officer and Mr. Jr.'s testimony at deposition that say that Officer Anderson affirmatively let detainees out of their lockdown cells.
So we have a declaration that is properly in the record from Juan Avila.
Juan Avila,
who's in cell 5. So another low
right.
tier
he
cell.
Says,
he
I
says
was
I was out.
Right. So he says I was out when I was not authorized to be out. Mr. Jr. and two other detainees who were supposed to be out say that Officer Anderson let other detainees out that weren't supposed to be let out. And so these acts were reckless. And in light of the knowledge that the risk that Officer Anderson herself identified prior to the attack, subsequent to that, she let lockdown detainees out of their cells, and then she left the tier unattended, basically ceded control to these lockdown detainees. And left
for how long did she leave it? Do we know?
That's not in the record. It's several minutes because the Mr. Jr. says the attack took several minutes and alleges that she was not there until after the attack was over.
And he does allege, does he not, that he's sort of crawling back to try to get help from, this is before he passes out. He gets back far enough to see she's not there.
He was attacked in the corridor, which is on the other side of the day room from where she's sitting. He gets attacked in there in the darkness. He eventually breaks out of the bear hug that he's being held in. He never sees his attackers, by the way. They attack from behind. He's calling for Officer Anderson's help the whole time, never sees her. And then he eventually breaks loose and comes back through the day room yelling for her help, still doesn't see her, and then he collapses up near the gate.
And this is all in his affidavit? Or
Yes, or in his deposition testimony.
So he's reporting enough of a memory up to that point that there is, in fact, something in the record. Okay.
Yes. And so her acts, in light of that knowledge, were reckless. And to corroborate her knowledge, she also tells us in her affidavit that she was aware that the detainees affirmatively would place small objects in the top of their sliding cells to prevent them from locking. So it's a strong inference that on the day of the attack, that was her conclusion 4 hours before the attack, that detainees in 6 and 19 were intending to get out. But she also tells us that sometimes when detainees are jury-rigging their cells, that it doesn't show up on her indicator. So there might be other ones attempting to get out that she's not even aware of. But here, just showing what her substantial knowledge or knowledge of risk was.
Are there previous incidents of this sort?
In the record of prior to this incident, there's nothing in the record that says this has happened prior, but she says in her affidavit that detainees occasionally do this to be able to get in and out of their cells. So I'm assuming that there's an inference that this has happened in the past where people come out of their cells and attack someone.
And attack someone. That's part of the evidence, too?
No, that's not part of the evidence. I'm saying that there's an inference there that our jury reasonably
concludes. They might come out and mingle, but not attack anybody. These two tiers, the upper and the lower, with the 20 prisoners, are these prisoners randomly distributed between the two tiers, or are they segregated in some way because they don't, you know, get along? And that's
there's no evidence in the record.
Nothing in the record
discussing how they're split apart.
Assigned,
Officer Anderson, in her response brief, argues that there was no objective risk. But if you look at her words, her written warnings, prior to litigation and prior to the attack, in her role as a security officer, a professional security officer, she assessed the situation, and her assessment was that there was a security risk. And I think that's strong evidence and allows a strong inference that there was an objective risk of harm as well.
So the record as of now doesn't show what these various people are in the prison for, I take it.
It's maximum security, Your Honor, so yeah. I'm guessing it's the most dangerous pretrial detainees from reading the cases in this court and others. Maximum 1, Division 1 is maximum security is a dangerous place.
Cook County, yeah.
Are there rules about what to do in the event of someone getting out?
I'm not aware of the rules of what to do once someone gets out. Now, here, the record...
Or once you mark security risk, are you supposed to follow up on that?
I'm not aware of what one must
do. So, as far as you know, there are no written rules to govern this?
I don't know one way or another, Your Honor. But she, after she was aware of the risk, however, she affirmatively, she committed an act of recklessness by allowing detainees out of their cells after she had identified that as being a security risk.
And so that's your Avila testimony or evidence?
That she, well, among, you know,
at
well,
a minimum.
Mr. Junior,
I mean, I realize we have all these things attached to his pro se brief, that some of which were before the district court, some of which were not. But Avila is before the district court.
Yes, and he was out. Yes.
Yeah.
And the second reason this court should reverse the decision below is because the district court abused its discretion in failing to recruit counsel based on Mr. Junior's second and third motions for recruitment. There's no question that this was a difficult case. The district court, when it denied Officer Anderson's first motion for summary judgment, had framed the outstanding issue in terms of her subjective knowledge. And this court has repeatedly said that in cases requiring proof of subjective knowledge of the defendant, that they're inherently difficult. And against that difficulty, Mr. Junior faced a number of impediments that together made it impossible for him to prepare and present his case before the court. He couldn't depose Officer Anderson in this case, particularly this case, where her subjective knowledge was such a key part, a deposition of her, was crucial.
So tell me a little bit more about, she says at one point that she didn't see anything, and doesn't she say at a different point that she observed the three individuals assaulting Mr. Jr.? I thought there were some conflicts in her accounts.
There are conflicts in her accounts, Your Honor. She initially says in her affidavit, or excuse me, in her answers to interrogatories, that she was aware of only one attacker, and that was Antoine Murray. In briefing subsequent to that, she admits that there were three incident reports. Now we know from the appellate record, which, again, was not before the district court, that there were many, many more, and she signed them.
But in the three, she says, I observed this,
yes,
doesn't she?
Yes, Your Honor.
So your theory, I guess, in part, is that counsel would have spotted these inconsistencies and probed them.
Absolutely, Your Honor. There's many. And she also says in her interrogatories that she didn't see the attack. And if she was there at all times, like she says she was, that's a weak statement that she was not. She did not see an attack of someone being stabbed 20 times by numerous attackers. An inference certainly is that she did leave the cell and then come back as the attack was ending, as Mr. Jr. ran up towards the security gate. But in terms of the difficulties Mr. Jr. faced, he also, in addition to not being able to depose Officer Anderson, he was under constant lockdown. If you look at he missed a hearing. He missed one of the hearings before the magistrate judge that involved discovery matters. And even prior to that, the hearing on August 24, 2010, the transcripts in the appellate record, typifies the difficulty he has. The court asked Mr. Jr. what type of discovery he wanted, and he said, I want this. And the court said, this is very inefficient the way you're presenting this over the telephone. Why don't you write a letter to the defense counsel? And he says, I've been on lockdown for 3 months. I can't get to the law library. I'll do my best. And then later on in the same hearing, he says to the court, I'd like to do some interrogatories. Is that something I can do? And the court says, well, why didn't you do it last hearing? And he goes, Your Honor, this is all new to me. I'm trying to learn. And so it typifies.
What is his educational background?
He told the court, not specifically, but he told the court that he had very low education and that he had very low reading scores. He doesn't quantify that.
Doesn't the prison have a record of prisoners' education?
It might be in their record. It's not in this record, Your Honor, so I don't know what his educational level is, but he says it's low. He also was on... also told the court that he had no litigation experience, and he also told the court that before the third request that he was on psychiatric meds. And if you take all these and stick them together, the other thing he told the court was aware he was at Menard during the entire time, 300 miles away, so he did not have ready access to documents or witnesses. And when you add all this together, it makes it clear that he didn't have the capacity to present his case and show that Officer Anderson had the requisite knowledge. And he suffered prejudice because it's reasonably likely that counsel would have been able to present this case in a way and discover additional evidence sufficient to survive summary judgment. Now, at trial, at this point, he lost his summary judgment. Whether or not he would have prevailed at trial doesn't really matter here. Counsel certainly would have been able to depose Officer Anderson and also would have defended Mr. Jr. Now, Mr. Jr. sat in handcuffs, undefended and unprepped for his deposition. That's some evidence that Officer Anderson relies on now. There wasn't anything particularly harmful in his deposition, but certainly counsel could have clarified some of his answers that are relied upon now. But additionally, counsel would have deposed a 30B6 witness and attempted to quantify the types of risks that are created when people sneak out of their cells undetected, or detected or let out, and also would have deposed Chief Officer Howell, whose affidavit was credited by the district court improperly for corroborating Officer Anderson's statement that she had no subjective knowledge. Chief Officer Howell was not there. He wasn't there before the attack or during the attack, and his statement that she had no knowledge of a risk was wrong. It should have been stricken from the record. And so,
okay, well, you should save the rest of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. So, Mr. Marsh?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Doug Marsh. I represent Officer Anderson. The only question that needs to be answered regarding plaintiff's deliberate indifference claim is whether plaintiff faced a substantial risk of serious harm, one that was almost certain to manifest itself if nothing was done.
So isn't there a substantial risk of danger whenever a prisoner is able to get out of his cell at an unscheduled time? And didn't Anderson know that that was a possibility when she saw that two cells did not register as secure? I mean, this isn't Boy Scout camp.
Well, as an initial matter, cell 19 is actually on the upper half of the tier. It's one of 10 tiers that are unlocked so that they could all be out on recreation. So the fact that that particular cell wasn't registering as secured at the time of the attack isn't particularly relevant. It was supposed to be open.
But Mr. Murray was in cell 6.
But Mr. Murray was in cell 6.
We have the affidavit from Mr. Avila, who's in cell 5, because Mr. Junior attached this document number 91 to his pro se brief, I think, that gives you the name of every person in every cell. So we know at least two low-tier people are out there, and this is a maximum security facility. I mean, surely Cook County doesn't just do this for fun, having people locked up in cells and having them go out tier by tier.
That's correct, Your Honor. In fact, this is a policy that exceeds the requirements of the Constitution. It even exceeds the policy and requirements of the Illinois County Jail Standards.
Well, there's the question is whether Cook County thinks, whether any rational person would think that having maximum security inmates wandering around when they're not supposed to be poses a substantial risk of serious harm to others.
Well, Your Honor, does it pose a risk of harm?
Certainly, I said a substantial risk of harm to others.
And that's right. And the answer to that question is no, there is absolutely no evidence, Your
Honor. You're kidding.
So was there no reason to have Anderson monitoring this?
Yeah, why
the cells and watching over the day room?
Well, there are a number of reasons why you have this policy in place, and one certainly is, yes, to avoid the possibility of inmate assault. There's also the risk of passing messages, passing contraband.
Is there a history of assaults? Are there records?
In the record, Your Honor, no, other than
Are there records? I'm not talking about the trial record.
Does Cook County keep records of assaults in the maximum security unit?
Yes, Your Honor, they keep those records.
Well, wouldn't they be relevant in assessing the danger?
Presumably they'd be relevant, Your Honor, sure. But
doesn't he need a lawyer in order to get hold of those records?
Well, Your Honor, remember, the only defendant in this case is Officer Anderson.
Why is that pertinent to Judge Posner's question?
Because
there's a defendant, and these records could shed light on them, and he wasn't able to think of getting them.
Because the only defendant in this case is the person whose subjective knowledge we need to identify. We need to know whether...
No. Look, what you say is, what's dispositive in this case is there's no evidence that there's substantial danger that when one of these inmates gets out of his cell improperly and wanders down to the next level, something bad will happen. You say no evidence of that. Well, the evidence might lie in the records of the jail, which might show that this is very common. That's why they have the segregation, and that's why they have a Miss Anderson supervising these people and recording security risk. What's she supposed to do when she records a security risk?
Her job, she's to note it in the logbook when she notices that a cell is
secured. That sounds ridiculous. She writes it in the logbook and then it sits there?
And then reports it to a supervisor.
And when?
Sorry?
How soon?
Immediately.
And did she do that?
All records seem to indicate that's exactly what she did. In Sergeant Smith's...
What do you mean? What are you talking about? What's the evidence that she reported immediately to a supervisor?
That's Sergeant Smith's affidavit, which is attached to the motion for summary judgment. And there's also the fact, Your Honor, that the day before the attack happened, a work order had been put in to try to do a maintenance check on these cells. In fact, Officer Anderson did exactly what she was supposed to do, and Sergeant Smith and Chief Howell both attest to that. She did her duty in this case.
Unless she left.
And
but, Your Honor,
supposed to walk away?
May I address that, in fact? There is no evidence that she left. The
but
three
there's Mr.
declarations
Junior's deposition.
There's Junior's evidence.
There's Mr. Junior's deposition.
What Mr. Junior says is that he was standing in the corridor, looking down the corridor, and did not see her in the interlock area. The
and then he also says he makes his way back to the room before he finally passes out.
If I may, Your Honor, the configuration of the cell, of the tier, is as follows. There is a corridor running right down the middle of the tier, and the cells are arranged in blocks of 10 cells on either side. And the interlock area, the office, stands right at the end of that corridor. To the immediate right of the interlock is the catwalk area, which then runs around the perimeter. Now,
is this in the record?
This is on the record, yes. When Officer Anderson...
Map in the record?
There's not a map of the record, no, but there's there's Officer Anderson's description.
Why isn't there a map in the record so that a reader could see what exactly the person in Anderson's position can see?
Because an oral description of the...
Well, an oral description is no good. Do you have dimensions?
Pardon me, sir?
Do you have dimensions?
I don't have the exact footage. I can give you a rough estimate. The day room is about...
That's so ridiculous. The case turns to a certain extent on what he could see, right, and what she could see, and a diagram showing the dimensions would be very helpful.
Well, if I may, Your Honor, again, the configuration of the tier...
If he had a lawyer, might have said, well, let's get a diagram of this and see what he could see.
Well, Your Honor, certainly Mr. Junior wasn't prejudiced because somebody wasn't there because...
What I find particularly disturbing is that Junior, he did not have a lawyer who could depose Miss Anderson, who is obviously a key figure in this case.
But he wasn't...
Deposed the principal, your principal malefactor. That's a terrible deficiency in case preparation.
But he was able to make and serve several interrogatories.
He wasn't able to depose her. Now, he couldn't depose her even if he weren't, you know, in lockdown. He doesn't have the ability to do so. A lawyer deposing her might have cleared up a lot about this case.
But he was able to serve those interrogatories, 24 of them.
But interrogatories are no substitute for a deposition. And there's this weird exchange. I don't know if it was between you or somebody else for Cook County in April 2011 when Anderson makes the second motion for summary judgment. Mr. Junior's not there. And there's this little chatty exchange between the judge and Mr. Groa. About whether the judge says there's been no attorney appointment. Mr. Groa says no. And he says, you probably like one, right, so you can understand the response. Mr. Groa says, actually, he's been doing pretty well. The judge says he has. And he says, okay, all right. And so the state's attorney and the judge decide that Mr. Junior doesn't need a lawyer.
Well, that exchange...
Which is an extreme...
As you know, that exchange occurred in April 2011.
Conflict of interest.
And
yes.
It was in January 2011 that the judge ruled on the third motion for summary judgment.
Right.
I'm sorry, the third motion to appoint counsel.
But it's just unbelievable. I mean, it sounds like the judge might have been willing to reconsider it, but the state's attorney says, oh, no, he's fabulous. You know, he should graduate from the Harvard Law School. It's just very bizarre.
Well, I imagine Jenner and Block's not holding a seat open for Mr.
What is his educational background?
As far as what's in the record, just that he has a low education. The Cook County Jail doesn't keep those records. They don't inquire as to the educational status of every one of the inmates.
You're kidding.
I'm afraid not, no. They don't go trying to track down to see whether they've graduated.
Question of tracking down. Doesn't a prisoner's record show his educational background?
To my knowledge, no.
What do you mean, to your knowledge? No. Have you ever looked at one?
Have I ever looked at the prisoner background? Yes, I've looked at the prisoner background. They generally tend not to show.
What do you mean they generally tend? They never show, or they sometimes leave it out?
It's not a formal part of the records. The educational background is not a formal part of the record.
Now, mightn't a lawyer have asked him what his background was?
A lawyer presumably might have asked him what his background was, but he did tell the judge that he had minimal education. The most important factor that the judge looked to in determining whether...
Why didn't the judge ask him, what do you mean by minimal education?
Because the judge made...
Read?
The judge made a simple inquiry based on his...
Well, that's not a simple... That's simple, but it's dumb. Because you want to know whether this person has enough education to be likely to be able to conduct a trial. And just the word minimal doesn't convey anything.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor,
what if he just went through sixth grade or something like that?
Well, the question isn't whether he'd be able to conduct a trial. That's the standard that this court expressly disavowed in Pruitt. He wasn't functionally illiterate, as demonstrated by the pleadings that he submitted, by his course of conduct.
Does he get help from prisoners on that?
If so, he doesn't say so.
Well, what does that mean, he doesn't say so? Does that mean he doesn't?
It says, I don't know who helped him, if anybody.
Yes, but look, the people who help him write briefs cannot represent him in court. They might write a beautiful brief for him, but that doesn't mean they can conduct a deposition.
But
right? You can't have a jailhouse lawyer conducting depositions for you, can you?
No, you can't.
No.
But he had made those interrogatories, and while they're no perfect substitute for a deposition, to be sure, he did make inquiries into Officer Anderson's state of mind, several important ones. For example,
but you sit down with the interrogatory, you think about it, how should I answer this and that. That's not the same experience as being deposed by a lawyer.
It's not the same experience, Your Honor, but that is absolutely not the standard that this court has required.
Can you imagine any lawyer in any kind of litigation, any civil litigation, saying we waive our right to take depositions because we've issued interrogatories? It's preposterous.
But
no
the
one
question,
would do that.
The question is not, and never has been, would a lawyer have done a better job?
We're talking about whether he could do an adequate job. And whether, actually, especially in light of our recent decision in Navajar, whether the district judge probed the question of what kind of job he could do at the trial with enough specificity about him to make an intelligent decision.
Well, what the court decided in Navajar was that the judge's continued application of this incorrect standard in Gill v. Reed needed to be done away with.
And stresses individualized analysis.
And there was an individualized
analysis. Well, no, there wasn't. It's
where
the
would
decision
we find
is,
that?
Yeah, right.
You would find that in each of the three orders.
The
denying
orders are about four lines long. There's no...
And this court has never required, or I've looked through every single case that this court has cited to Pruitt since its decision, and it has never held that a court which did apply the Pruitt standard, but did so cursorily or briefly, needed to be remanded. In fact, in one case, Shelby Potter.
Well, maybe that's a mistake.
Well,
those cases really say that sound bad.
Your Honor, what we see in Judge Aspin's orders is that he made a determination that the case was simple. It was. The only issue remaining after
no,
the
it's
first...
Not. It's not. It's a difficult case. It turns on all sorts of stuff which nobody knows. For example, is it really dangerous to allow a person in one of these tiers out on the other tier? By the way, how are prisoners assigned to tiers? Is it random? Or
no, it's not random. And the
all right, what are the criteria?
Well, the assignees for Division 1, it's a maximum security tier. The ones who are held for more dangerous crimes are typically those housed in those facilities. Most of the key players in this case were in for murder. Mr. Junior, for example, was.
My question is, you've got the two tiers. Now, how are prisoners allocated between the tiers? Is it random?
I apologize, Your Honor. The entire block is considered one tier. There are 10 cells on either side. No.
There are these two tiers, separate tiers, and they're not supposed to mix in the day room, right?
That's not correct, Your Honor. That's not correct. Twice a day, as a matter of fact, all of the inmates are out for lunch and for dinner. They can all mingle together. There's no rule that...
The question is, how are prisoners allocated between the two tiers? Is it random, or is there some criteria for why you're in the top tier and someone else in the bottom tier?
As between the two halves of the tier, there are no particular rules that say that some inmates need to be here or there, unless it's the case that one of the inmates poses a known risk of harm and needs to be isolated from the others. And that's what we don't have in this case, Your Honor. We don't have this specific...
You say there's no known criterion?
In fact, even plaintiff has no reason...
Random?
Plaintiff says so himself.
Random. Answer my question.
I'm not sure I understand it.
Is the allocation of prisoners between the two tiers, is it random?
As inside the tier itself, yes. There's no particular way to assign prisoners to one tier or the other, unless it's the case that one of them presents some sort of a specific threat of harm, in which case he is isolated. What we don't have in this case is any evidence that either plaintiff or Officer Anderson knew that this attack was coming.
But
it was
that's
a complete
not the
surprise.
Only situation in which there can be deliberate indifference, that you know that inmate A is going to assault inmate B. There are some other situations that could be reckless.
Only where it is a highly probable consequence.
Right, right. And
for
that's
example,
where the evidence that Judge Posner is talking about how many assaults are there and how dangerous are these people and why does the policy exist at this time of day of letting them out to the day room only lower tier and then upper tier. You know, there are quite a few questions.
But make the comparison to this court's previous cases. Brown v. Buds, you have an inmate who's known and has a history of assaulting Caucasians. You
so
have
it's
Hillman.
Not quite the same as this case. That's why we have more cases.
In fact, it's an entirely different level altogether, Your Honor. It demonstrates something far beyond deliberate
indifference.
We didn't
say in that case, or to my knowledge in anything else, that we had exhausted the possibilities of the theory that people are entitled to physical security inside jails and prisons.
There is a certain baseline inherent, as it were, dangerousness that's inherent in the prison facilities, and we don't have any evidence to show that Officer Anderson could have known that the potential for these inmates to get out of their cells presented that objectively serious, substantial risk of harm, almost certain to materialize if nothing was done. There's just not evidence to that point.
There's no almost certain rule. But anyway, you've made your point.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Do you have anything further, Mr. Lay?
Your Honors, unless you have any further questions, we would rest on our opening argument, and thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. And were you representing Junior on a pro bono basis? Well, we thank you very much for your efforts. And we thank Mr. Marsh as well for his vigorous defense of his client. Next case for argument, United States versus Jackson. Mr.